It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore new voices of democratic socialism in the state legislature and how it speaks to Wisconsin politics today. The formation of a socialist caucus is the first to reach the legislature in over 90 years. Call in with questions and comments about socialist representation in state politics. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Darren Madison represents the 10th Assembly District covering northern Milwaukee neighborhoods Glendale and Shorewood. Representative Madison, welcome to the Ideas Network.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And Ryan Clancy represents the 19th Assembly District, downtown and Shoreline Milwaukee neighborhoods. Representative Clancy, welcome.
Thank you so much, Kate. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with the why. Why have you campaigned and defined yourself politically as a democratic socialist? I want to ask you both, and Representative Clancy, you first.
Thanks so much. Yeah, no, I think especially coming off of a pandemic where folks' basic needs were often left unmet, we are seeing a resurgence of socialism and socialist policies really all across the United States. And I am honored to serve with Rep. Madison. Prior to this, and actually during this, I was able to bring some really wildly popular socialist policies to the county board here in Milwaukee. And I'm looking forward to expanding that into the state.
One in particular had legs there at the county level.
Yeah, so we were able to pass something called the Right to Counsel, so that right now in Milwaukee County, if you meet the income requirements and you're facing eviction, you will be provided an attorney. And that's kept thousands of people in their homes. It hopefully will continue to keep thousands of people in their homes even after the pandemic is in our rearview mirror. We passed paid parental leave, and both of these policies are incredibly popular and really making a significant impact to working households in Milwaukee. We'd love to see those same things across the state.
Representative Darren Madison, what's in the why for you?
Yeah, in general, let me start with why I ran in general. I ran because I, you know, wanted to honor the legacy of the 10th District and its amazing leaders who have always put people first. Running as an open democratic socialist, I ran under that ideology because I believe in putting the working class first, fighting for unions, and fighting for a worker-controlled democracy in the economy.
How do you see democratic socialism in the neighborhoods you represent, Representative Madison?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have a portion of River West. I see it in the cooperatives that have come up on the north side of my district. I see it in the ways in which communities and neighborhood groups have come together to build models that ensure that residents are supported by each other, right? If we are implementing models of cooperative economics, which is rooted in, a model rooted in Black history, that's how I see socialism being applied in my community. And as I've talked to more residents during my time running for my seat, they remember Milwaukee socialist history. And they're looking forward to seeing how it applies under our leadership in the state assembly.
And we're going to talk further about that history in Milwaukee in a moment. But I want to turn to you, Representative Clancy. When we think about grassroots neighborhood efforts, cooperative economics, as Representative Madison put it, can socialism function and thrive in a capitalistic society, or I'm going to quote, Senator Bernie Sanders here, an uber capitalist system?
Absolutely. And what that looks like initially, especially, is harm reduction, right? So if you take something like the Right to Counsel, which provides attorneys for folks facing eviction, that is only necessary because in this larger society, we don't look at housing as a basic human right, and we should. And I think looking at how we meet people's basic needs and prioritizing those first really has a lot of effects on you know, everything from crime, which is something that a lot of folks want to talk about these days, to you know, to the economy more generally. And that's something that, that we as a larger society haven't gotten right yet. But we don't need to look far. We don't need to look to other countries, their implementation of socialism and socialist policy. We have socialist policies right here in Milwaukee. Like I said, they are both popular and they have data to support how effective they are. As it turns out, if you work on the front end to make sure that somebody doesn't experience homelessness and that they have advocacy during, you know, one of the most difficult parts of their life facing an eviction, then you don't have to spend those dollars on the back end trying to, you know, get them into temporary housing and shelter when they lose their home. So it's not only the right thing to do, but it also makes, you know, real economic sense.
We're talking about state politics with newly elected members of the legislature's Socialist Caucus. That was Ryan Clancy there, and we have Representative Darren Madison from Milwaukee as well. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Your questions about state politics with socialism in mind. Let's turn to you, Representative Madison. And, you know, we've been hearing a bit from Representative Clancy about, you know, homelessness and sheltering and keeping people from not being evicted. What are your top priorities in the assembly?
Yeah, absolutely. My biggest priority is fighting on behalf of opportunity youth. Young people between the ages of 16 and 24 that are out of school and out of work. We have over 100,000 of these young people in the state of Wisconsin. Those are young people who are in our foster care system, young people in our juvenile justice system, young people who have been pushed out of schools, and young people in their early adulthood who cannot find work. So as it relates to the committees that I'm on, you know, criminal justice and public safety, workforce development, children's and families, and corrections, I have a unique opportunity to put forward policies that ensure that we are thinking about those young people and we're ensuring that they have the ability to thrive.
How are they falling through the cracks now in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so, you know, I think about young people who have some amazing experience through some work that they've been able to accomplish, but sometimes they can't get positions because they don't have college degrees. So looking at some job requirements, right, that we have in the public sector as well as other opportunities, also thinking about ways in which we can ensure that young people are receiving adequate training and opportunities to build their skill sets, right? I think of programs that are currently doing that, like IC Stars, which is creating pathways for young people in technology. I think about our apprenticeship programs that are happening throughout the state that are creating more opportunities for young people to access union fair-paid jobs, you know, fair-paying jobs. And then I think, you know, more specifically, black and brown neighborhoods where you have more programs looking at how to holistically approach ensuring young people are developing the skills that they need to not only the soft skills that they not only need to be able to live thriving lives, but also, those workforce development skills as well.
Mm-hmm. Milwaukee Democratic State Representatives Darren Madison there and Ryan Clancy, the legislature's newly formed Socialist Caucus, and what they have in mind. Be part of this conversation by calling with your questions or your comments on socialism. Share your memories of what it was like in Wisconsin's past. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A pair of assembly members formed a socialist caucus that's been dormant since the 1930s, and we explore how they plan to spread their platform, grow their caucus, call in about socialism, past and present, and what it means for Wisconsin politics today. 800-642-1234. Email your questions to ideas@WPR.org. Democratic Representatives Darren Madison and Ryan Clancy of Milwaukee, stay with us. I'm going to turn now to that history grounded in Milwaukee, home to one of the most prominent socialist movements in history in our country. And let's hear some tape of Frank Zeidler, the former Milwaukee mayor, city's third socialist mayor, led was the last socialist candidate to be elected mayor of a large American city. And here he is addressing the Green Party National Convention rally in 2004.
When you see the decent housing, particularly public housing units that were built under the socialist administration with environment particularly in mind and social justice in mind, you can know that you are in a comfortable environment.
Lingering on those words there, Representative Clancy, what impact has Zeidler had in your foray into politics?
Yeah, I mean, you know, coming from Milwaukee, you can't drive over a bridge or go through a park without being reminded of our socialist history. And they got some things very right. I mean, is that emphasis on really unsexy socialism? It was the sewers, right? They were called pejoratively sewer socialists, and then worked to reclaim that language and saying, yes, like people want, you know, significant investments in that sort of infrastructure that keeps things working. They were really great on public health, which in 2023 is probably newly relevant. And one of the things I think that we can build on and do better on is equity. So you actually heard Zeidler there talking about public housing and making that an issue. And that was one of the things that they got right as well. And in fact, they faced a lot of criticism in their time for integration, because that was one of the effects of public housing. But we can do better. And I am so thrilled that I'm, you know, serving alongside Wisconsin's first black socialist elected. And that is a really big deal. And I'm honored to be serving alongside him.
Representative Madison, what does this history mean to you?
Yeah, similar to Ryan, you know, our socialist history feeds into an expectation that we invest in public infrastructure, right? Zeidler, you know, purchased one of the city's first garbage trucks. He built new fire stations. He, you know, supported, you know, roads infrastructure. But he also, you know, like you know, the interview said, he also supported public housing, right? All of these things have had benefits to all communities throughout the city of Milwaukee and Wisconsin to an extent, right? And we need to ensure that we're still making investments in public infrastructure, right? Sometimes as I look at the history after socialism, we failed a few times as it relates to bold investments in public infrastructure, and we need to be able to do that effectively, so folks can have the resources that they need to thrive.
Local governments are struggling to find that funding in order to keep those services running, to keep those services functioning, and we've seen some Democratic and Republican bipartisanship on shared revenue, sending more state funds back to local governments. Representative Clancy, as you look at what is being proposed in the legislature and by Governor Evers, whose budget would devote 20% of our state sales tax to funding shared revenue, what comes to mind? What do you think? What do you support?
Yeah, and I think we have more reason than ever to be really optimistic about the idea of shared revenue. I think finally, at long last, folks from both sides of the aisle can look around and say, no, we have seen our local governments at the county and municipal level being starved of resources. And in fact, one of the reasons that we may see some actual change on that this session is that the vast majority of new electeds are coming from that local government background. And we've seen what it looks like to starve a local government of resources. And that's really where a lot of the, you know, the most vital infrastructure and the services that are most visible to folks happens. You know, that's the libraries, that's transit, that's parks. And we haven't seen yet the investments that we need over the years. I am really hopeful that we can finally make some headway there. I think the battleground is going to be where those dollars are spent, and that if local municipalities and counties are able to retain the autonomy to spend those dollars in the ways that make the most sense for their residents and not the priorities of state government.
Well, let me ask you this. In response to that, Representative Madison, in exchange for this additional revenue that's flowing to local governments, or that will additional revenue that will flow, do you support making them institute new cost-saving measures or other ways to tighten up their spending?
So I think that the city has been making the city and the county, specifically in Milwaukee, have been making astronomical choices to you know, do cost savings measures, not because, you know, because we have to, right? Mm-hmm. We've been in a deficit, approximately a $10 million deficit every year, ever since 2010. And that means that, you know, with that loss of revenue, you know, we have to make choices, tough choices. I think that realistically, we're getting to a point where there aren't many more cost-saving measures that can be done. We actually just need the ability to generate more revenue in ways that's meaningful, right? Other cities of our size have so many levers that they can pull to generate more revenue, and we don't. So this is a step in the right direction, not necessarily asking us to figure out more cost-saving pathways, because we're already doing that work, but ensuring that we're getting a better quantity of revenue in which we produce for the state, because we produce a large sum of the GPR for the entire state as the city and as the county.
Milwaukee Representatives Darren Madison, Ryan Clancy with us as we talk about state politics through the lens of the Socialist Caucus. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Representative Clancy, you said you wouldn't be a party of two for long. Do you have any new Democratic recruits 2 months into your first session?
I don't want to tip our hand yet, but certainly there are many folks who are looking at, the socialist policies that have already passed in Milwaukee County, the ones that we're advocating for at the state level, and looking at that as a viable path forward and a way to address not just common sense policy, but kind of an attempt to change the system behind it. And I think we're going to see some traction soon.
Representative Madison, what issues do you want to push the Democratic Party further left on? Where do you see you wanting to move the party?
Yeah, I mean, as it relates to bolder investments and off-ramps for young people in our youth justice systems, actually fighting, I'm hoping to fight for pathways to ensure young people have year-round employment opportunities, as, you know, our economy is facing, as our communities are facing, you know, several layers of issues. Young people are moving into the workforce at younger ages. And I don't like that some folks are introducing policies that, strip away child labor laws, right? I'm interested in, you know, getting my colleagues to explore issues that are near and dear to my heart, like opportunity youth, like bold investments and offerings to our youth justice system.
Do you think you can be effective passing legislation or getting movement on legislation as a two-member caucus?
I do. I do think that we can be effective. Just like every other legislator, in the Capitol, right? We are all carrying the mantle for our districts, and we have to think collaboratively how to work on behalf of all Wisconsinites. I believe that there are inroads as it relates to certain issues as opposed to others, and I think that folks are willing to make that, you know, put that hand forward and collaborate.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Milwaukee Democrats Darren Madison and Ryan Clancy, they're members of the legislature's Socialist Caucus. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hundreds of books and magazine titles are banned inside Wisconsin prisons, and that includes pornographic magazines and books that describe techniques for making weapons or illegal drugs. But the banned books list is also far-reaching enough to prohibit manuals on computer coding. And some advocates say the restrictions make it harder for people to expand their education while behind bars. Sarah Lear reports.
Marianne Olson spent more than 5 years behind bars in Wisconsin. While she was there, she says she asked for books to try and keep up with her prior career field of web design.
My incarceration was to help me understand not only why I made the poor choice I made, but to learn a better way. And in my mind, that meant a strong vocation.
But Olson, who had a job driving a van for the prison where she was incarcerated, says her access to those books was denied.
Here I am being handed keys to a vehicle and allowed to leave every day. And yet a book that would teach me how to use Microsoft Front Page was a security risk.
Prison officials screen inmates' mail and other reading materials. Wisconsin Public Radio used a public records request to obtain a list of the publications that have been approved or denied. The list shows officials used a policy banning anything deemed a threat to security to bar access to multiple computer literacy books. That includes titles like Coding Made Simple and Microsoft 10 in Easy Steps. Even so, the Department of Corrections says certain tech-related books could be allowed if they're part of a course an inmate's taking. A spokesman for the agency says the prison system has expanded its job skills and educational opportunities. But Moira Marquis doubts the logic behind many of the department's restrictions. She leads a prison writing program through an anti-censorship organization called Pen America.
The stated rationale, I think, is that people are going to develop into computer hackers and hack the, computerized systems of security at the facilities, which is a pretty far-fetched paranoid fantasy when it comes to a book like Windows 10.
Marquis believes concerns about security can snowball into banning a wide range of books that are considered subversive.
It's, I think, unlikely that security is really being served by limiting what people can read.
Wisconsin prison officials prohibited scores of books because they contained nudity or were deemed pornographic. A book describing how to fund a cannabis business is banned because prison leaders say it advocates breaking state law. So is one on rope knotting techniques, which officials say could be used to escape. The restrictions also extend into the realm of fantasy. In 2005, a Wisconsin inmate sued after his Dungeons & Dragons books and magazines were confiscated. That suit was dismissed after a prison captain argued the game could foster gang activity and encourage escapist fantasies. But prison reform activist Dante Cottingham says books, whether escapist or not, are a lifeline to people behind bars. He argues book bans are about imprisoning minds.
There's a deep sense of oppression inside of prisons. That's simply another part of their oppressive intent to prevent you from growing, from feeling empowered.
Cottingham was released from Wisconsin prison last year. One thing he's enjoyed since getting out? buying books that used to be banned. Sarah Lear, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And to browse the full list of banned books and magazines, check out the online version of this story at WPR.org. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, addiction to a highly processed food may be more common among older Americans than addiction to alcohol or tobacco. That is one sobering takeaway from the University of Michigan National Poll on Healthy Aging. Call in with questions or thoughts about processed food, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ashley Gerhart is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, where she is the director of the Food and Addiction Science and Treatment Lab. Ashley, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So your poll found about 13% of adults ages 50 to 80 report being addicted to processed foods. Almost half report at least one symptom of food addiction. What qualifies as a food addiction?
So in my lab, we take the exact same criteria we use to diagnose an addiction to alcohol or nicotine or cocaine, which are these specific behavioral profiles. I'm a clinical psychologist, so if somebody comes into my office and I'm trying to understand, are they a social drinker or are they having a problem with alcohol? I look for things like, are they losing control over their intake? Are they having such intense cravings they can't focus on other things? Are they trying to cut down and they can't? Are they continuing to use this way even though they're maybe having some significant problems in their life? And when they try and cut down, do they sometimes report signs of withdrawal, irritability, agitation, feeling physically unwell? And so we apply all of those diagnostic criteria to the intake of these highly processed, unnaturally rewarding foods to see whether people experience similar addictive indicators in the way they consume them.
So when I think of ultra-processed food, I think of fast food. But can you also just frame for us what you're talking about here in processed food?
Yes. So what my lab uses as a term is highly processed. And we use that to capture foods that have high levels of refined carbohydrates. That would be something like sugars or flours, and or added fats, butter, lard. Now you can go and you can buy sugar and butter at the store and you can make homemade cookies or, make a homemade pizza. And we'll find that people report struggling with that at times and overeating that and overconsuming it. But in our society today, there's another designation called ultra-processed foods. And those are the industrialized versions of these sorts of unnaturally rewarding foods. So that is your drive-through cheeseburger and fries, your breakfast cereal that's really sugary. These are ones that are created by the food industry that are often, not only do they have high levels of sugar and fat and salt, but they're very shelf stable. They're amplified by food additives. They're really cheap and convenient and heavily marketed.
Breakfast cereal kind of takes my breath away because I don't think about it in that category because it's become so much a part of the morning routine as we pour into that cereal bowl. People are doing that right now.
Absolutely. So, there's a lot of what we call health halos around a lot of these foods that actually have unnaturally intense levels of sweeteners in them. And our brains are so sensitive to sweet taste. We come out of the womb loving sweet taste. We're designed for it because it makes us want our mother's milk. But the sorts of foods that exist in our current environment, like those sugary cereals, another one that I think has a big health halo are yogurts that have fruit in them, the fruit-flavored yogurts. Mm. But actually, these cereals, these yogurts, they have tons of added sugar in them, as much as if you were eating candy. But we think of them as healthy. And so people can eat these foods and not be informed of the risk. And then all of a sudden, you pop open the box of cereal and, oh, I still have a little more milk. So I need a little more cereal. Now I need a little bit more milk. And the next thing the box of cereal is gone and you're feeling pretty uncomfortably full.
What is significant about these addictions being reported in older adults, older Americans?
you know, older Americans have really been understudied in this area of addiction to highly processed foods. And that's a real concern because a lot of the health consequences of over-consuming, you know, highly processed foods really don't come to bear until older adulthood. Things like diabetes and heart disease and certain cancers that are implicated in our diets. And one of the things that we find, you know, really striking about addictive substances is that when people want to cut down, when they want to quit, they know it's bad for them. They know their smoking is giving them emphysema, and they know their alcohol is really leading to issues of blood pressure. They try and they find that they can't. And typically, this has been kind of in our society is just kind of shaken off as, oh, this is just, you know, if people just had a little more willpower, they could do it. Mm. But what we realize with addictive substances is they're really engineered and designed to hook you and make it hard for you to quit. Right now, we're seeing that people are dying early from really poor diets dominated by highly processed foods at levels that are really on par with what we see with cigarettes. And people know, you know that a lot of these foods are not great for them and they want to cut down. The diet industry is a $1 billion industry, but people find that they can't even when they really want to. And I want to kind of challenge that narrative that it's just that people don't care, they don't have willpower, but to focus on the fact that these highly processed foods, especially the industrial versions, have been explicitly designed to maximize the bliss points, to induce craveability, to trigger moorishness. So you want more and more and more. To me, that all sounds like different ways of saying they're addictive.
What about your genetics? If you have a family history of addiction struggles, are you more at risk here?
Absolutely. We've done some work on that in my lab. And we see that most of the work is focused on a family history of alcoholism, alcohol problems. And this has been a focus because we've seen that children who've never had a drink of alcohol, but whose parents have an alcohol problem, that they have a special relationship often with sugar. They prefer more intense levels of sweetness. They're more likely to experience pain relief from sugar. And so there's clearly this alcohol, family history of alcohol, sugar sort of connection. So in our lab, we looked at whether a family history of alcohol problems predicted being more likely to experience an addictive response to highly processed foods. And people were about 2.5 times more likely to have an addictive response to highly processed foods if they had a parent who had alcohol problems. This is actually, this association was even stronger than the ability of a family history of alcoholism to predict whether you yourself will have alcohol problems. So it really suggests that there's something going on here about your genetic risk, your family history risk of addiction, and your propensity to struggle to manage your intake of these highly processed foods.
Ashley Gerhart heads up the Food and Addiction Science and Treatment Lab at the University of Michigan. Call in about your tendencies with highly processed food. What questions surface for you in this form of addiction? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. University of Michigan researchers, they analyzed survey responses from thousands of older Americans about symptoms of addiction to highly processed foods. Be part of this conversation by calling in with your questions, your comments about food addiction, 800-642-1234. Ashley Gerhart is director of the Food and Addiction Science and Treatment Lab at the University of Michigan and is a clinical psychologist. Ashley, I want to turn away from looking at family history for a moment to talk about the environment an elderly person might live in, their quality of life issues. How can being on fixed incomes or having limited mobility affect the food choices and the food a person is able to get?
I think that is one of our biggest challenges when I think of this work. You know, not only are these highly processed foods so rewarding and tempting, and they make you crave them and want to seek them out, but they're also very cheap to make on an industrial scale. And the ultra processed versions of these foods are very convenient. Often they can just sit on your shelf. They're ready to eat. They're ready to heat. And for a lot of people, especially if they're living alone, I mean, making fresh meals that are going to stick around, that are going to feed you, can feel expensive. It can feel overwhelming. It can feel like too much food. If you're having mental health problems like depression, it can feel particularly difficult. And what we have seen in some of our work is that food insecurity, you know, not feeling like you have enough money every month to be able to afford the food that you need, it really increases the likelihood that someone's going to be showing these signs of addiction. It's really stressful, and you're more likely to have to rely only on highly processed foods to get your calories every day. So it's very clear to us that the answer to this is going to be on an environmental level, on a societal, on a policy level in large part. And the older Americans really need to be a focus of this, to think about policies and programs to provide them with convenient, easily accessible, nutritious, nourishing food. And that should help support both their physical and mental health.
Just to follow up on the program side, considering Meals on Wheels saying it supplies 2.4 million meals to seniors every year nationwide, the quality of meals varies. Are senior food assistance programs part of the problem?
There is some evidence that the way our current programs are operating, programs like SNAP, to provide supplemental nutrition assistance, that because of the economic differences in what it takes to buy ready-to-eat and prepared highly processed foods versus nourishing versions, that people who are on SNAP actually eat more of these ultra-processed foods than people who are struggling to make ends meet but aren't on SNAP. Mm-hmm. And so I think we really need to be creative. You know, we've called it food insecurity for a long time, but it's not just any food. I think there's a focus on shifting the term to nutrition insecurity. So you might be able to have access through SNAP, through a meals program, to, you know, a frozen pizza or, you know, chicken nuggets that you heat up in the microwave, but that we need to make sure that people are getting the actual nourishment of fruits, vegetables, lean meats that are created in a way that's appealing and convenient and affordable for them.
Thank you for making that distinction. It really makes me think differently about that term, food insecurity, that we hear so often. Let's turn to treatment. How should food addiction be treated?
So I think that the first thing I always recommend to people is a sense of radical compassion. When I talk to people who are struggling with this, there's a lot of self-hatred and a lot of self-blame. And the societal message is that if you just tried hard enough, you know, you could tackle this really easily. I think sets a lot of people up to fail, because there are trillion-dollar food industries designing and engineering these foods to make it hard to eat them in moderation. And then when you don't, the blame's put solely on you. And it's kind of using our brain against us. You know, we're designed to find sugar and fat rewarding to help protect us against times of famine, but our brain never evolved to handle the magnitude of the reward that's triggered by these sorts of foods. So I suggest to people that, you know, providing yourself with some gentleness can be an important next step. And then we see for a lot of people that this is often can be about regulating emotions or dealing with stress. And so we'll have people kind of journal about, what are your triggers? Are there certain people, certain times of day, certain meetings that trigger you to want to eat in this way? And then we'll help people develop alternative strategies to regulate their mood or to remove those cues from their environment to help them develop a better handle on their relationship with food. And sometimes, you know, I was originally an alcohol researcher, and I kind of thought maybe this wasn't going to be as severe in the context of food, but it really changed my mind, because the cues for these highly processed foods are just everywhere, from your first morning meeting where people bring donuts to going to pick up some paper at Staples and you're checking out and there's tons of candy at the checkout, the advertisements on TV. And so people might need some extra support from a health professional, mental health professional, or a support group to really help them navigate this.
Talking with Ashley Gerhart, Director of the Food and Addiction Science and Treatment Lab at the University of Michigan. You can join in with your questions and your insights on food addiction, 800-642-1234. Ashley, I wonder, are scientists still at odds about whether ultra-processed food addiction is a real thing? I mean, do you find, is there still a lack of uniformity in thinking, or does that perhaps even take away efforts to land treatments for food addiction?
Yeah, so this is definitely still a topic of debate. I would say that the scientific field has come to more of a consensus that we're seeing the signs of addiction in ways that people eat. I mean, people are clearly losing control and having intense cravings and getting a diagnosis of diabetes and then struggling to change their diet. Now that I would say that the debate is centering on more, well, what is it really about the food? And for me, when I look at the benchmarks that we used and the big debate about whether tobacco could be addictive, I mean, that was a huge debate for decades, that whether they were really addictive, you know, they're not intoxicating, they're legal, they're easily accessible, but they were killing hundreds of thousands of people every single year and people couldn't quit. When I look at real nourishing whole food, we can't get people to eat enough fruits and veggies, even if we make them free, even if we do these big educational campaigns. It's not budging very much on a societal level. In contrast, these unnaturally intensely rewarding foods that really trigger reward systems of the brain at a similar magnitude as things like alcohol and nicotine. Mm. These are foods that are killing people. They know that. They want to cut down and they can't. To me, that's really a classic indicator of addiction.
In our last minute or so together, what's next for your research? Where do you take it?
Yeah, right now, we're actually looking into some work to see what happens when people who show signs of addiction to these foods try and cut down. One question is whether there's a sort of withdrawal syndrome. So when people try and cut down on smoking, at first you think you're going to feel better, but for those first couple weeks, you can have really extreme cravings and feel irritable and edgy and a little down. And the longer you stay off the cigarettes, the better you feel you recover. But it can be a real obstacle to quitting. We're seeing evidence that this also seems to occur when people try and change their diet, that they also show classic signs of withdrawal. So we're going to be looking at how the body and the brain and people's moods are impacted when they're first trying to shift their diet, so we can better support people from getting over those, you know, maybe first couple of weeks that might be a little challenging.
Ashley, thank you for joining us and sharing your research.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Ashley Gerhart is an associate professor of psychology at University of Michigan and director of the Food and Addiction Science and Treatment Lab. Find a link to the study results at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.